Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. We said last year when Officer Arianna Preston was murdered outside her home, it'll happen again. It'll happen again to a police officer, just as it happens to people from all walks of life in Chicago, because that's what happens when you turn your city over to lawlessness, which is what has exactly been done. And so, unfortunately, it happened again over the weekend when off-duty police officer Luis Huesca was shot to death in what appears to be a carjacking, though we don't know,
right,
while he was returning home after duty to his to the Southwest Side. Still in uniform was the report. Mm-hmm. So, again, we don't know if the shooter saw that he was a police officer and decided to murder him because he didn't want to get caught carjacking a police officer. We don't exactly know yet, but we know that another officer has been gunned down off duty. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, he was on the force for 6 years, 30 years old, about to be 31. Tomorrow is going to be his birthday, and it just ShotSpotter is one of the reasons that alerted him, the authorities, to 55th and Kedzie. And that ShotSpotter alerted them 5 minutes before somebody called 911. So, I mean, that's an ancillary issue. We could discuss that, too. But it's just so indicative of how this city is falling apart and just destroying, eating its own. I mean, we've got rules in place that are going to go by the wayside because ShotSpotter is going away. We have no respect for human life, even if you're a police officer or a regular civilian.
Superintendent Snelling had this to say.
He was just a great officer, a great human being, and his family is dealing with a lot right now.
Yeah, I'd say. And we're going to hear, well, we've already heard from the politicians, of course, the politicians that platform defund the police, decarcerate criminals, that demonize police. We're a week removed from the demonization of police at the hands of these same politicians and their functionaries with respect to the police-involved shooting of Dexter Reed, in which the footnote was Dexter Reed opened fire first and shot a police officer, could have killed that police officer, thankfully didn't, but could have. The idea that you would be surrounded by police and you would open fire is probably something that comes as a surprise to a lot of people. I don't know why they'd be surprised. No accountability for thee means no accountability for me, as has often been said on this show.
Well, the officer's car was found about a mile away in an alley. Here's Alderman Lopez.
Vehicle found in the alley here. We believe it was the officer's. If this was a carjacking, there might be evidence inside, or an attempted carjacking, who knows. But again, all of that's being collected right now.
And the irony
he doesn't
is,
know anything more than anybody else does, of course.
Yeah, well, I'm just letting people, I don't know if people knew that his vehicle was found a mile away. And this officer, Huesca, was, he made a video last year for Andre Vasquez Lopez, who was shot and killed in the line of duty.
Lasso.
But I'm, it's just so ironic that here he is, he's talking about his friend, and then he's dead less than a year later. Sickening.
So now we're going to hear this has to stop. Anybody have any ideas on how to make it stop? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. We're going to hear from politicians the thoughts and prayers. We'll have a maybe politician show up to the funeral service. We'll hear a lot of talk about this sort of disembodied gun violence that just occurs. It's not really perpetrated by anybody except the NRA, of course, but it just occurs. And we'll hear, tough talk from FOP. We already have. Predators, lawlessness. So last week we had a conversation with John Garrido, retired Chicago police lieutenant. And we were talking about, of course, the police-involved shooting of Dexter Reed and all the furor after the body cam videos were released. It's still ongoing. And I noted something. I saw that FOP had made a $10,000 donation to Justin Slaughter's campaign. He's the state rep who sponsored the Pritzker Purge Law, the so-called Safety Act. And it was basically concurrent with voting to sweeten the pensions of police officers. And I just asked John Garrido, and sort of put him on the spot, but I mean, I would ask any police officer. I would ask Catanzaro if he would have shown up last week. What exactly is going on here? And this is not an accusation. It's a query for an explanation. So on the one hand, it's the tough talk. It's the opposition to the Pritzker Purge Law and the Safety Act. We talked to former top prosecutor Bob Mylan last week. We already know what's happening as a result of the Pritzker Purge Law, the so-called Safety Act, just as we predicted, just as is obvious to anybody who understands the basics of how people respond to incentives, criminals too. So it's making the situation a lot less safe for everyone who is law-abiding. And, well, even those who aren't law-abiding. It's just basically engendering more lawlessness than Chicago has historically experienced, which is quite a bit. So what is going on? It strikes me as a little bit of a 30 pieces of silver moment. Maybe that's going to be received as harsh, but I know when I'm going to hear. I'm going to hear that it's just playing politics. You got to play politics. You got to play the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same conversation we had about Jonathan Jackson with the firefighters. When Jonathan Jackson said white firefighters just let the homes in black neighborhoods burn while they work diligently to save homes and lives of white people in the white neighborhoods, basically what he said. The firefighters union, once this got around, outraged. They retracted their endorsement of Jonathan Jackson. Oh, well, why'd you endorse him in the first place? What's going on there? 30 pieces of silver moment? Or is that too harsh? Just playing politics. Got to play politics. Well, if you're just going to play politics the way that you've just been playing politics, this isn't just on the unions for first responders, but it includes them. They don't get a pass. And I know that Chicago police and first responders and the city is mourning the passing, and maybe this is too soon, but I don't know. This has been happening for long enough that I don't know that too soon is operable anymore. Do you? So maybe you're not as good at politics as you think you are. You know how I know? Because officers keep getting killed. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Jim, Southside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I'm a retired Chicago police sergeant, and politics in the city has been here for hundreds of years, and it's ridiculous, and it's not effective as far as policy goes to keep our citizens safe, in my opinion. The bottom line is that the ShotSpotter works. It has worked. And are trying to get rid of the ShotSpotter because it makes the city look bad, because it amplifies and makes the police able to get there quicker to maybe catch the bad guys in the act of shooting. They don't want that. They don't want that because it makes them look bad with their policies, in my opinion. the bottom line is this, that the politicians, they have bodyguards like Johnson does. They have J.B. Pritzker. They have all these politicians have bodyguards to protect themselves against their own inept policies, which they keep on perpetuating in the name of political correctness to the citizens of Chicago. People are voting with their feet and they're leaving the city. They're leaving the state of Illinois, and they don't care about it because they're getting illegals in here now to pick up the backfill. It's sad, and it's very, very pathetic that the city keeps on going down a drain, and yet politicians don't care because they're being taken care of, and they always get their paycheck, and they always get their re-election because it's a corrupt system that they have here, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I think your opinion's accurate. I share your opinion. Thanks for the call, Jim. But we're going to hear this has to stop. That's what everybody says they want. Of course, nobody wants people to be murdered. So so is it too soon to ask, okay, well how? Do you have any ideas on how to make it stop? ShotSpotter, I mean, yeah, of course, ShotSpotter is a useful technology. And it, you know, it goes off like a game show in Chicago, of course. It does make the city look bad because the city is bad. On the score of keeping people safe, there's no question about it. But as I understand it, that cop was DOA. Obviously, ShotSpotter didn't save him. So, I mean, it's part of the conversation, but it's not fundamental. Right. Fundamental is we have a city where cops get killed walking to their front door.
Right, where cops get killed after a long day work at work, going home, and They Snelling yesterday, the superintendent said, we're not sure if he knew if he was a cop because he thought he might have had his jacket on, but they weren't sure. But still, it doesn't matter whether you work for the city or you live in the city, you're not safe. And that is the bottom line.
It is. And so for the people who say and are going to hear the disingenuous empathizing from politicians of this has to stop, what do you got? What do you have? What, ban assault weapons? What do you got?
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Insight into what it means and the sharpest of things. There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the murder yesterday morning of Chicago police officer Luis Huska. The mayor issued a statement. I'm going to hear the mayor's statement.
Yeah, I mean, it was just weird. He didn't show up at the hospital at University of Chicago. You know, Superintendent Snelling was there normally.
He has a black wife and three black kids at home.
Yeah, that's right. He might have had soccer.
Yeah. I've got things to do. Mayor Johnson's met with Officer Huska's mother and uncle this morning, assured them they have the full support of my administration in this deal with this unspeakable loss. Our city is grieving, and our condolences go out to their entire family, as well as Luis's fellow officers and community. My Office of Community Safety, in collaboration with the superintendent, committed to putting every resource available toward apprehending anyone involved in this morning's shooting and bringing them to justice. As the investigation continues, we'll provide immediate updates as they become available. Cut, paste. The alderhuman for Gage Park also issued a statement. Alderman Gutierrez. I talked about the violence that impacts their community. Violence. Heartbreaking loss is a reminder of the violence hurting our neighborhoods. Is it the violence, the disembodied violence, or is it the violent? This has to stop. Okay. How? How? Does that seem like a fair follow-up to a declarative statement by your elected officials?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Do you think that we're the only ones who notice this? And by this, I mean, well, let me give you an example. To notice things like this, occurrences like this. Meet number 63 from 2022, charged in connection with the 2022 expressway shooting near Chinatown. A lot of those, you know, in the hundreds every year. Do you think people notice those or just us? I mean, I'm not talking about the Chicago Press Corps. I know they are willfully blind. I'm talking about other human beings, other three-dimensional human beings that live in Chicagoland. I mean, how many people are impacted by a couple of hundred expressway shootings a year? I know it's a small percentage of a metro area of 7 million people, but I mean, it has a ripple effect, doesn't it? People notice these things. Number 63, when he was allegedly involved in that 2022 expressway shooting near Chinatown, he was awaiting trial on charges of aggravated battery by a firearm. And gosh darn it, Kim Fox is devoting all of the office's resources to interdicting violent gun crime, don't you know? So he's waiting trial on aggravated battery by a firearm, and then he allegedly opened fire on the expressway near Chinatown with another dude. He was the 63rd, is now the 60, because, you know, this cleanup of what happens on a real-time annual basis takes years. He's the 63rd person accused of shooting, killing, or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago in 2022 while on felony pretrial release. The crimes have involved at least 107 victims, 29 dead. This is what we call preventable crime in common parlance. Do you think anybody notices this in the non-law-abiding community? Do you think anybody notices this guy more recently? Linder Jose Galvez Carbajal has been arrested two more times since CWB Chicago updated his forays into the Chicagoland community since he arrived and was put up at the Standard Club as part of a migrant encampment paid for by you.
Of course. I wouldn't want it any other way, Dan. Really.
I mean, of course.
I work hard for other people all the time.
You have to earn the welcoming title. It's not just given to you.
Yeah.
Target employees reported he stole about $40 worth of Modelo beer in Santa Margarita on April 2nd. That was a recent arrest. But so he's a nonviolent crime. So he's released. He's nonviolent. Oh, yeah. A week later, he was arrested after a Chicago Fire Department crew returning from a job saw him beating up another man in the 1300 block of South Canal. And by the way, before that, before he was released after his most recent alleged theft, his previous arrests battered two migrant shelter employees. Shoplifted from Nordstrom Rack. Shoplifted from Marshalls, shoplifted from Walgreens, shoplifted from Burlington. He's been arrested seven times this year, and he's in this country illegally. You think people notice that? Does that send any sort of signal to people who have a gimme dat mentality? I want that, so I just take it. Or I don't like you, so I'm going to eliminate you. Slighted
me. Served me, so I'm going to eat you.
Yeah, you slighted me in some way. Or or whatever. Or I just, I don't like honkies or whatever. Does this go unnoticed? Are we the only ones who see this? So what are the implications? While you have the condolences to your family, pro forma from city and state politicians.
Oh, they all commented yesterday. I can't even read them. It's like, just please stop. Sit this one out. You're not doing anything to help the situation, so don't try so hard.
And so are we the only other ones to connect the dots as well? So this lawlessness that you speak of, we speak of, everyone speaks of, there's just a dark cloud over Chicago. It just occurs like the weather. It's just natural forces. Or are there responsible parties? And if they're responsible parties, could you please identify them and tell me what should be done about them? And I mean, I mean the actual assailants, too, the people who commit crimes, yeah. Because this seems to be very much in question as well, what we should do with people who commit crimes.
We take care more of the criminals than the victims. I don't care. And Brandon Johnson, don't let him fool you. The stupid statement he released out, the, you know, pro forma, this is... He's wanted to defund the police. Don't forget what he's all about. Friday,
well,
red shirt wearer.
If there's somebody who is unclear about Brandon Johnson or thinks he is, he or Pritzker for that matter, are friends of law enforcement? Well, but that's my point.
Right.
So the same people who say we need to do something, this has to stop, are some of those people saying that Brandon Johnson has an idea, J.B. Pritzker has an idea, or what they've done to date, particularly Pritzker, he's been in office longer, has helped the situation?
No.
Is there any kind of assessment being made?
He pretty much
is there any kind of reflection being offered that says maybe the Pritzker purge law, even the 2.0 version, wasn't such a good idea? Maybe, you know, we should do something different. If we want things that are bad, like people being murdered, police officers being murdered, to stop. I don't hear that conversation.
No, because that'd be admitting that they were wrong.
Ron, Southside.
Hey, good morning, Danny. Well, you know, if you didn't see that guy was an idiot, I've been on every station, and I know I told you all, he's the last person. Now people are like, hey, Ron, you're right. He's an idiot. Mm-hmm. And his response to crime is we need more resources. We need more investment. We need more affordable housing. I'm going to tell you, man, that guy is a complete idiot. Oh, yeah. Even though there are companies begging people, you know, to come and get a job. The guy is a complete idiot, scumbag. Have a good day.
Well, he says we need more resources, and he's taking resources away like ShotSpotter.
So, I remember that it's always what people aren't doing. What do you want people to do, and how are you going to encourage them to do it? You know, politicians respond to pressure. Mm-hmm. So he's taking away ShotSpotter. He used to support defunding the police until he, you know, middled the issue when he became a politician. So, keep going. I saw somebody on the board said stop and frisk. And I'm sorry, who is going to implement that?
Even implement foot chases, let alone stop and frisk. What?
Do you see the question that everybody wants to avoid? I don't think it's that complicated. I think people know what the question is. I don't think they have an answer for it, which is why we talk around it. he's doing this and he's doing that and he's doing the other thing and that's all bad. Yeah, I know. So what do you want to do about it? Nothing really. Or I don't know. I'd like to do something, but I don't know. That's fair. But if you're not even having the right conversation, then this is sort of the same masturbatory exercise that the politicians do and are doing right now. And by the way, this is a feature, not a bug. I know the specter of politics. This is a feature, not a bug, of the identitarian movement, which is housed in the Democrat Socialist Party. Karen Bass, she's the mayor of L.A. Just to give you some perspective here. Look around the country. Look for patterns. Karen Bass is the mayor of L.A. Mm-hmm. She was a congresswoman for quite a few years, 6 or 7 terms. Here's what she says about no cash bail. The same thing that New York moved, and then the same thing that Illinois moved with Pritzker's Purge Law, besting New York in the elimination of cash bail, pretrial detention, essentially.
I mean, it's really an embarrassment on our country that we have more people locked up in the United States than any place in the world. And if you look at the many, many, many people who are locked up, they're locked up because they're poor, because they can't afford bail, or they can't afford proper legal defense. If you dealt with the poverty aspect, you could probably reduce the population by 50% with that alone. You know, why are people incarcerated just because they can't make bail?
Updating that story, one person in custody after the home of L.A. Mayor Karen Bass was broken into early Sunday morning. She was home during the robbery. She was unharmed. Well, even with a security detail.
Yeah, where
in
were
LA.
They?
Yeah. And Baltimore?
Yeah.
Here's a BLM Brandon Baltimore version. Brandon Scott with a big announcement.
For too long, public dollars have simply just gone to the big names and the big players in town. And dare I say, I know my staff is going to hate this, the big names and big players in town that just happen to be white-ran organizations in Baltimore. This investment made possible through the American Rescue Plan Act, thank you, President Biden, thank you to our congressional delegation, underscores our dedication to ensuring that all artists and communities have equitable access to resources, opportunities in Baltimore.
That was an announcement like the announcement that BLM Brandon Chicago made. We're using COVID funds to pay for being a welcoming city, to pay for all that we're offering people who come here illegally. BLM Brandon Scott in Baltimore, BLM Brandon Baltimore, BLM Brandon Chicago, keep them straight. That was an announcement. They're taking COVID funds and using those funds to give to minority artists because minority artists don't get enough public funding in Baltimore. They go to white organizations, as you heard BLM Brandon Baltimore say. Baltimore is one of the most violent cities on a per capita basis in the country. It's right there with New Orleans, St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Houston. The case of Mario Young. Mario Young and another dude took some money, took some stuff from a convenience store. The clerk went after him. Clerk went after him to get his stuff back.
And clerk got fired?
Or at least to call, you know, to get information so he could turn it over to police. He followed them. Okay. They shot and killed him. And he has been released.
Walking to the Sunoco Friday morning, the clerk walks in behind them. Surveillance shows one of the teens put a bag of chips in his pants. Both teens leave. The clerk walks out to confront them. The teens walk away. It's the last time we see them on surveillance.
He had his car keys in his hand, and he started yelling to them to come back. He's like, hey, hey. They initially looked back at him, and they flipped him off, and then they continued on their way. And he was saying, hey, again, hey, come back here. And then they started jogging.
The witness says the clerk followed the teens in his car.
He turned to kind of pull up beside them, and that's when I was up and I was turning the opposite way. Next thing you know, I heard two gunshots, and I looked back and I could see the shooter firing more shots at the car.
He saw the teens run away in different directions, rushing to help the clerk. He calls 911.
And I'm sitting there saying, hey, buddy, man, hey, dude, are you okay? So when I looked in through the window, he seemed to be unresponsive.
Community activist Quanell X says the shooter, 17-year-old Mario Young, and the second teen are claiming self-defense, saying the clerk had a gun.
Did you notice any guns or weapons inside the car?
I didn't see any guns. I didn't see a gun on the seat or next to him.
Think people are aware of that in Houston? Word gets around?
I just wanted to bring this to people because the officer who was killed, Officer Huesca, he paid tribute to Officer Andre Vasquez Lazo last year in a YouTube video.
This is not a symbol of us versus them. I hate injustices and lawlessness as well. That's why I became a cop.
Yeah, so what are you going to do about it? So it needs to stop. Yeah. Yeah, needs to stop here, needs to stop in Houston, Baltimore, L.A., New York. Anything that those communities and so many others share? Any commonalities you see there? And it's remarkable, too, because we watch cities and college campuses being taken over by these pro-terrorist protesters. And we can't muster from decent people anything more than a, this has to stop. This has to stop. Yeah, I did my part. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook. Or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Sort of dovetailing on the conversation we had in the first hour about the murder of Chicago police officer Huesca over the weekend. Luis Huesca.
Did you see his picture? I mean, he looks so happy. And the officer that I spoke with at Newham said he was always in a good mood. He was always so positive and just a joy to be around. And he worked in the same district, the 5th District, too, as Officer Preston, who was murdered, too, while she was on her way home from work.
Walking into her home.
I know. In uniform.
Right. But I know. It has to stop.
Right. Somebody tweeted that out, too.
Things men do that make them look...
So Tucker Carlson was on Rogan's podcast recently, and he said something I've been saying for a couple of decades, but because he said it, people actually pay attention to it. So I'm going to want to replay it So maybe if somebody else says it, somebody else, other people will pay attention. I don't know. I was unable to get anybody to pay attention in Illinois, but maybe Tucker Carlson can help. And it's in the context of the foreign aid package that Speaker Johnson pushed through the House and over to the Senate for Ukraine, for Israel, and for Taiwan, about the nature of evil, Tucker Carlson on that topic. And, my version of it would be nice guys. Nice guys. You've probably heard me say on this show 100 times, everybody's nice in Springfield. Everybody's nice in Washington. Everybody's nice in your village government, your school board, your school administration. He's nice. She's nice. And then they go to these repositories of power and do some very not nice things. And there's just a total absence of understanding that in places that have just given up on civilization, given up on living in a civilized place, being part of civilization like Illinois has.
Here's the illusion that we fall for time and again. We imagine that evil comes like fully advertised as such, like evil people look like Anton LaVey.
Horns,
yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Black cloak.
Exactly.
Sickle.
Evil is an independent force that exists outside of people, that acts upon people. I really believe that. I've experienced it a lot. And it's obvious. And what vessel do they choose? The weak. It's weak men and women who are instruments of evil. The weaker the leader, the more evil that leader will be. So it's, and unfortunately, we've reached a time in American history where every leader is either a woman or a weak man, pretty much. And so there's, I'm sorry to say it, that's just true. And the weaker the leader, that's what Mike Johnson, everyone's like, oh, Mike Johnson's such a nice guy. Well, I know Mike Johnson, and he's a perfectly nice guy to the extent that he's like polite and seems kind of meek and restrained, and he's not saying motherfucker ever, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? He's got like very sort of buttoned down affect, but he's a weak man. And that's the man you should be afraid of. The people who you shouldn't be less afraid of are the, you know, headstrong, loud, don't care what anybody thinks. Yeah, those guys will go off track, but they're probably not going to abet, you know, genocide or blow up the world in a nuclear exchange, because they may be obnoxious, but they know who they are. Weak people just become a host for evil, you know, an open, empty building that evil occupies, possesses even. And that's exactly what's happening to Mike Johnson. It's like absolutely crazy what Mike Johnson is doing. But it's not because he's evil. It's because he's weak and therefore susceptible to evil. It's a meaningful distinction that I have noticed.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Tucker Carlson's hardly the first to notice this, but it is important. I mean, if, you know, back when we used to have thoughtful people in positions like, I don't know, the papacy, you would have commentary on this very topic and reminders to world leaders, not playing sort of pedestrian politics like even our religious leaders do today, but reminding public officials, reminding people in positions of authority that their duty is to do good, and here are the forces they're susceptible to, minding Acton's admonition that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so good versus evil, your charge is to do good. And so you have to reflect upon the virtues that are supposed to provide the foundation of who you are and how you think and how you would make policy. And you're also supposed to be aware, cognizant of the pitfalls. Right. Evil never comes dressed up as evil. It always comes dressed up as a false good. That is not a Tucker Carlsonism. That predates him by a couple of popes. So at least, actually. But this is an important point to revisit, because we're wooed by false goods presenting themselves as nice people who are empty vessels who do unspeakable evil, but they do so with a room temperature disposition and a sort of a hail fellow, well met ease about them. Dick Durbin is a good example. Huh. Bruce Rauner was a good example.
Oh, yes.
Mitt Romney is a good example. There are a lot of examples. They're empty vessels who are just essentially bundles of appetites, one of them being ambition and status. And that's what drives them. And so they do things that, right, the bloviator, the bombast, would not, but you know where he stands and he know who he is, would not do. It is an important conversation, perhaps more important than ever, as we have so many empty vessels just rife through our cultural and civic institutions. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636-DA, turnkey.protextline. All those nice people. I know my alder human. He, she is a nice person. My state rep, my congress human, my senator human, my governor human, and so on and so forth. Oh, yeah, I know them, and they're nice people. This mm-hmm. this rent seeker,
yes.
This rent seeker, this big contractor, he's a really good guy. Mm-hmm. Empty vessel in service of something other than your interests, Chicago's interests, Illinois' interests, society's interests. I mean, do you ever like really try to think through, is there anything that lies beyond that, behind that facade of pleasantries and attaboys and that's a catch up for a cocktail? And then you find curious alliances and strange decision-making that doesn't seem to square with what they were presenting or are presenting publicly or presented privately to you. You ever think anything of that? We were just having this conversation about the unions. I'm talking about the police and fire unions this time, not the usual suspects, not the usual public sector unions, AFSCME, SEIU, and the teachers. Well, is somebody off limits here? I thought you want bad things to stop. But we can't have tough conversations. I want bad things to stop, but I don't think they can, so just continue to spoon-feed me the beautiful lies. At least that's honest.
And I do think that Tucker Carlson might have listened to one of your podcasts at some point in time.
Well,
the way.
I doubt that, but
or great minds think alike, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you just if you think at all and if you read, then you'll come upon these concepts. There's what's the slogan for, and borrow from Harry Truman, by the way, in-depth history with Frank from Arlington Heights on Tuesdays. There's nothing new in this world. It's just the history you don't know. Yeah. Well, that's generally true of ideas. I mean, particular innovation in a particular field. But I mean, the ideas about man and society and God, there's not a lot new under the sun. It's just new to you, generally speaking. New to a lot of people who haven't taken the initiative to consume such information and consider it. Nice people doing not nice things. I can't believe how foreign a concept that is in a place like Illinois. But it is. It really is. No, not that person. Every time, long ago I stopped being surprised when, stay on my side of the aisle, when Republicans went to Springfield and did the bidding of the other side. Long ago. We used to have these conversations all the time. Assessing not personal, this pro-life and pro-Second Amendment, whatever. It doesn't matter what the person says he or she is if I don't believe that they can stand up under any pressure. And so that was always the assessment that we made when it came to supporting candidates. And, of course, we made mistakes, too, and we had to make some difficult choices, too, where you didn't really believe in either, but you had to take a flyer on one. Those were your options. The best options we could unearth when I'm talking about state legislative races in particular. So a lot of disappointments. It just goes with the territory. And now you hear Tucker Carlson's obvious and unsurprising disappointment with Mike Johnson after the week he had last week. And I share his disappointment. Reauthorizing FISA without a warrant provision and the aid package for
Ukraine,
Taiwan, and Israel with no consideration for the southern border. So we have the power of the purse matters when it comes to spending other people's money on other countries. And we're hamstrung. We're hopelessly hamstrung when it comes to spending other people's money, but on those other people whose money it is to provide for public safety, first and foremost, on our border. Yeah, I think that's a difficult position Mike Johnson put himself in with
some
conservatives.
Egg on his face, yeah.
He doesn't think so. And
no,
you know,
he doesn't. And then they're all sitting, like, idiots are waving the Ukrainian flag. Stop it.
Well, that was a pretty disgraceful scene. And in addition to that, did Mike Johnson move both of those measures, one or both of those measures, to secure enough votes from Democrats to say Speaker if there's a motion to vacate? I mean, I'm not saying he did, but now you have to ask the question. I mean, Mike Johnson is a bright guy, and I thought this, boy, this is good. You got a real conservative, a philosophical conservative, but you can be a philosophical conservative and also be weak, and also succumb to pressure or the woo of the title. The title becomes more important. I must maintain the title at all costs. And if that means cutting deals with Democrats and advancing their flag, then I'll do that. We can go back and forth because I know, I mean, on the foreign aid funding, on the FISA warrant, I can't imagine that there, after everything that's occurred over the last 8 years, that there'd be too many conservatives who didn't want to see at least a more buttoned down version of FISA that offered a little bit more. And it's just a little bit more restraint on the FBI. But no. Because Christopher Wray said national security is at stake. And the Wall Street Journal did too. So 285,000 illegal searches of, you know, data searches of Americans. Nah. We'll do better next time. Oh, hey, that's good enough for me. But it's got to stop. This has to stop. The lament of the powerless. Well, maybe some people, while they're reading and thinking about these things, may want to pick up Vaclav Havel's Power of the Powerless. There's another good manual for a peaceful, popular revolt against a oppressive political class. I don't know. I don't know what it takes to get to people. I really don't. Not in Chicagoland. Roger in DeKalb, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, just a word on the origins of the word nice as opposed to kind. Kind is actually an ancient Greek word, biblical terms. Christ was always described as kind. People who were nice were kind. But nice actually came from 14th, 15th century Europe, I believe France, I believe Nice in particular, and it had to do with the schmoozing ability of the vendors to make a sale. So it's got sleazy origins, and it just continues to be such. So have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Roger. Yeah. So it's the right word, but not for the reason most people think. I think it's a compliment rather than just an accurate description. Craig, Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, good morning, Dan. Maybe thanks, Dan, for taking my call. Now, this point about Mike Johnson being like a godly man, Christian, all this stuff like that. I can see right through that thing, and I'm going to tell you how, because there's a biblical example where Jesus is talking to the scribes and the Pharisees, who are supposed to be the religious elite and all that stuff. And Jesus says, you're a brood of vipers, kill of dead men's bones. You didn't study the scriptures because you think you're going to attain eternal life. There, the scriptures testify to me. That guy Johnson, I think he's basically, they're totally like way off in both categories.
Well,
nice guy and everything like that. Good.
Yeah, I mean, let's not, like, you know, condemn him to the hellfires quite yet. We've all exhibited our moments of weakness. I certainly have. And so that last week was depressing week. I think it was a week, W-E-A-K, week for Speaker Johnson. But I don't think he's a fraud in terms of his faith and certainly not his intellect. But I just don't know how strong he is. I don't know how strong he is in that environment where strength is required, and strength coming up from a position of godliness, if you will, and small C conservatism is even more needed.
Hey, real important. Now, I don't disagree with you, but my point about Mike Johnson isn't that he really or knowingly is a fraud. He doesn't know. Just like those, there's people that are in high places with religion. They think they're preaching the truth or telling the truth, and they're lying. But I mean, I shouldn't say it. They're off. They don't really know the gospel. The gospel is one thing, and then all these other religious thoughts and religious ideas are something else. And that's what I think about Mike Johnson. He thinks he's a Christian. People around him think he's a Christian. I don't. You can tell him by the fruit they bear. You can see the decisions he makes and everything like that. Where the innocent, he's not protecting the innocent or worried about justice or anything. The things that God's interested in, he doesn't seem to be interested in.
Well, thanks for the cockroach. I my intuition is that he's an authentic Christian. But you can be an authentic Christian and be a weak leader. And not everybody's cut out for leadership. And maybe Mike Johnson isn't. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Brotherly Love Spice, Representative Ilhan Omar of the Socialist Spice Girls, her daughter, who attends Barnard College, Hunter Grand a year, one of the seven sisters, she was arrested, and then she was suspended, apparently, for taking part of this encampment on the campus of Columbia University to support Hamas and Iran and other enemies of the United States, to wish death upon America. You know, the usual stuff that offspring of the wealthy and powerful are engaged in. And now she says she's homeless.
And
she's been evicted from campus housing, banned from using the dining hall. She's going to starve on the streets of Columbia University.
She has nothing to eat, Dan, and nowhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they zip tied her for 7 hours.
It's a good start. UPS executive daughter, UPS executive's daughter, who killed an elderly couple in a crash as a teen. She was among those in the anti-Israel protest. Also, a Letitia James intern. Just an intern? Where was Letitia James herself? Alvin Bragg, too, for that matter, the whole crew. By the way, it's not just for Columbia. Columbia is getting all the ink, but I'd like to expand the circle if I might. Yale, lot of pro-terrorist undergrads at Yale. Like, here's one offering a rap in the face of a Jewish student as the mob, you know, looks on campus for Jewish students to harass.
So it's about to get wavy. Israel, Israel. Israel, Israel. I am mobbing us in Palestine. Free Palestine. Israel, but God. Same land, why you are in China robbing? Prophets, y'all just want the profit.
It's not the same, not being able to hear all the expletives, but I think you get the gist. It's less than complimentary. More from Yale. This is where the mob takes down the American flag with a bunch of honkies in keffiyehs celebrating and ululating.
Viva, viva Palestina!
They just got to see that, hear that at the end. What is needed, the coup de grace, to top off a fun pro-terrorist rally party on the campus of Yale? You know, you had the rapping and accosting of Jewish students. You had the Death to America, take down the American flag, dress up, you know, play dress up in the garb like you're a member of the Islamic Jihad.
Right.
And what you really need, though,
what?
To tip it off, or to top it off, I should say. Well, you need the drag sermon. The drag queen sermon.
Oh, OK.
So it was quiet time.
Now too?
Quiet time. And all the terrorist sympathizers got together in the steps of one of the buildings. And listen to some dude in drag who goes by the stage name of Tifa Wine offer this, I would say heady, but it's just like a bunch of Marxist newspeak strung together. So this person's attempting to sound intelligent. But listen to this. And this went on for like 6 minutes. Come on. How about just a pithy Death to America chant already?
Yet institutions like Yale maintain onto the mythology that real pedagogy lives here, criticality thrives here, and that the colonial classroom can be a site of ongoing self-making. There is no place for academic freedom when dispossessed lives are on the line. We do not need to enroll at Yale to seek real pedagogy, for we all know that Palestinian voices and the Palestinian struggle has become one of our greatest teachers in theorizing what it means to be resilient in the face of unimaginable dehumanization and pain.
Another like a dude in a sequin dress saying pedagogy 6 times in 90 seconds. At Northwestern University, my alma mater.
Oh, yes.
You know what happens when if I'm talking about Northwestern, that means it's in the news, which means what?
The value of your degree goes down.
Correct. The dean of students at Northwestern attended an anti-Israel protest on campus this week that was targeting Hillel. They want the university to end its relationship with the Hillel Community Center on campus. Yeah, obviously, of course. Stop associating with the Zionist organizations and so on and so forth. And, of course, Michael Schill is a pathetic, small little man, so he can't stand up to this nonsense. And I mean, they have the right to say whatever they want, but I mean, this sort of like a moral equivalence, right? The Pontius Pilate routine here, and really, it's not even Pontius Pilate because there's essentially tacit support for these illiberal forces on campus. And by the way, nothing new at Northwestern. When I was there 30 years ago, the BDS movement was already alive and well in Northwestern. I did an alternative to the daily paper with largely other Jewish students, Jewish conservatives, who are now like, you know, brain surgeons and neurologists and stuff. And I was the weak link in that intellectual herd, obviously. But the anti-Semitism was rife on campus back then. It took different forms, but nothing has changed. It's just more people are aware of it now. And because of social media, more people are aware of it more quickly. But like the seeds of what you see at Yale and Columbia and Northwestern were planted generations ago.
Okay.
And I just don't think people appreciate that. All right. For more on all of this, there's a lot. We're pleased to be joined again by our friend Leo Leibovitz, who is... with Tablet Magazine. He is the editor-at-large for Tablet. He joins us now. Leo, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hello, friends. I'm also a survivor of Columbia University.
That's
oh,
right.
Boy.
I forgot you were a professor there, so you know this student body well.
Sadly, I do. Look, Dan, I think the last comment that you made is actually crucial. People look at this, and they ask this question that every normal, you know, mother and father or student in America asks, you know, hey, how could this happen suddenly? And the thing to realize here, it didn't happen suddenly. It happened over 30, 40 years. It's the result of a deliberate plan by lawmakers, by so-called intellectuals, by political operatives who hate America to basically create these, you know, madrasas in the heart of American cities and indoctrinate our children.
Right. And it seems to be going quite well. I mean, you know, for them, yeah, and yet, despite the big flourishes that led to the ouster of Claudine Gay and the University of Penn president, so on and so forth. I mean, you know, you're right back to it. I mean, it snaps back that fast. This is so ingrained that a couple of heads rolling professionally will not change the landscape.
I think the only thing that would change the landscape are two beautiful English words, defund and deport. First of all, a large quotient of people. Yeah, you mentioned rightfully so, because it's the most kind of like unbelievably enervating thing to understand, all these children of immense wealth and privilege who are cosplaying, you know, revolutionaries and waving anti-American and anti-Semitic flags. But quite a few of the people who we see behind these rallies, and again, let's remember that Colombia's acceptance rate is 3.8%, which means that these people were specifically chosen, an immensely large foreign student body population. We have simple laws on the books that say that if a foreign student comes here with a visa, we love this, we encourage this, we want everyone to come here and enjoy our fine, you know, world's best educational institutions. But if you're going to come here and cheer for a terrorist organization, we have laws on the books to kick you right out. These laws need to be utilized. And second of all, we need to tell universities, basically all of whom, all of which use or receive public funding, that if you do not stand up to this kind of absolute insanity, you will lose every last cent that you have in federal support.
Yeah, I mean, DeSantis has said something to that effect with respect to, you know, where he has some sway. That would be the state of Florida and state universities there. But you know, it seems to me that even if you did that, you did attach consequences to this disturbing behavior. And I'm not saying that you don't do this, but I still think that will only result in that crew coming over the top. And it will. The only thing that would be good about that is I think it forces the hands of the administrators if something like that happens. And then they have to choose sides, because so many are trying to pretend that they're not choosing sides, even though they essentially are by deference.
I think that's completely correct. Look, if we're being honest about it, and this is a sad and difficult thing for many Americans to hear and understand, especially so many of us have always come to see college, or at least for the last 40, 50, 60 years, come to see college as this great big engine of upward mobility. But that's maybe, I tell my they're 12%, I tell them 3 times a week, you are never going to college, because I'm not going to pay $250,000 and waste 4 years for mutually accredited mediocrities to turn you into Nazis. It's just not going to happen. I think step one is to really build, you know, alternate institutions, and some of them may be universities, like the University of Austin, Texas, which my friend Barry Weiss and others are helping to build. Some of them may be, you know, professional schools to make sure that we actually have tradesmen who know how to make things and fix things here in America. And some of them may be completely radically new approaches to education. But we could begin. These are very large societal, you know, sea changes. But we could begin right here at home by doing exactly what you said, Dan. Like, hold these administrators' feet to the fire, and not by, you know, firing one mediocrity and replacing them with another DEI-approved mediocrity, but by actually making the university obey the law.
So, what would you do if you were a Jewish student right now at Columbia or at Yale? I mean, at Columbia, they're learning remotely today. And it, I mean, I just, wouldn't you fear for your safety, and would you stay at either of those places?
I would leave immediately. I am frankly completely overwhelmed to try and understand why there is still a single Jewish student at Columbia. Look, you know, Jews sadly are still somewhat traumatized by the Holocaust, understandably so. And the question that we always like to ask is, well, if the Nazis come again, what will people do? Will they rise? Will they resist? Will they protect us? You got the answer in Columbia University right now. It's not just the, you know, radicals at the encampment. It's the fact that not a single professor, not a single student stood up and said, this is absolutely revolting. Not in my name. I refuse. Give me back my money. No one did that, which as a student should tell you that you're surrounded by, you know, moral monsters, and the level of actual education that you're getting in this place is worthless. And if the only thing they have to offer is some dwindling amount of prestige, hey, that's just not good enough reason to put your life at risk. Leave.
Yeah, I mean, Jewish students and Jewish people are literally being poked in the eye. Miss Israel, literally being, you know, her eye blackened by these protesters in New York. I mean, it's I don't know. It's pretty stark. It's the sort of the question I ask about Chicago all the time. I mean, what exactly is confusing to you about what is happening? I wanted to get your reaction to something else. You know, this sort of two sides of the mouth type of approach that the Biden administration is taking with respect to Israel. On the one hand, moving along with, of course, Republicans, moving aid for Israel in the ongoing war against Hamas, and mouthing the words of support for Israel's right to defend itself. And then the report is that animatronic Anthony Blinken expected to announce within days sanctions against the IDF, a battalion of the IDF, for human rights violations in the West Bank. So how do you suss that out?
You know, there's an old kind of Arab folk tale about two birds. They're watching a hunter, and he's killing birds, and it's so cold, so his eyes are tearing up. And one of the birds says to the other, "Look what a good man he is. Sure, he's killing the birds, but he cries over it. It gives him a great deal of suffering to take lives." And the other bird says, "Don't look at his eyes. Look at his hands." I think with the Biden administration, you shouldn't mind anything that these people are saying. You should mind what they're doing. And here's what they're doing. They're pushing Israel to, quote unquote, cease fire when we still have 133 civilians, including two babies, held captive by this beastly terrorist organization for 199 days. They're pushing Israel to build special construction so that we could drop more and more aid, knowing full well that the aid is seized by this terrorist organization that is only going to use it to inflict more suffering, not only on Israelis and Jews, but also on Palestinians. And now they're coming up with complete trumped-up charges because, God forbid, there will be one side that's morally correct and one side that's morally evil. We don't believe in good and evil. We have to create a semblance of, you know, a cycle of violence and mutual responsibility. And so now we have to sanction the Israeli army as it's trying to defend itself. It is completely reprehensible. And honestly, at this point, any Jewish person who supports the Democratic Party is operating for out of reasons that I simply can't understand.
Leah Leibovitz is the editor-at-large for TabletMag.com. TabletMag.com is the website. Leo, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know we have serious business to address, but before we do, I did feel the need to revisit the fantastical story of the fabulist in chief, that would be Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, and Uncle Bozy, who was eaten by cannibals, he insinuated. Well,
stop it.
Peter Doocy asked KJP about that at the press briefing, and here's what House spokeshuman had to say.
There's no evidence of that. And why is he saying that his uncle was eaten by cannibals? That's a bad way to go.
He lost his life. It's not, look, I'm not, we should not make jokes about
it's
this.
Not wait, President wait. Biden said no, that his uncle was eaten by cannibals.
I mean, your last line is... It's for a laugh. It's for a funny statement. And he takes this very seriously. His uncle, who served and protected this country, lost his life serving. And that should matter.
Don't joke about cannibals.
Oh. Yeah.
really does, KJP, drive me nuts listening to her. She is such a dim bulb, really. That should matter. As any, if anybody is questioning the service of his uncle, we're questioning his Commander McBragg routine. You know who should be the White House spokeshuman for President Biden?
Who?
Brian Williams.
Oh.
They could see who makes up the most fantastical stories.
Yeah, that's true.
Boy. Anyway, this, by the way, while we were talking about whether or not any members of the president's family had been devoured by cannibals, this was going on in capital cities like our neighbor to the north, where they've got that, that grade school drama teacher they made the prime minister. We were just talking about what's going on college campuses. How about what's going on in downtown Ottawa?
From the river to the sea. From the river to the sea. When I say from the river to the sea, you reply with Palestine is almost free. Because our resistance attacks are proof that we are almost free. October 7th. It's proof that we are almost free. Long live October 7th. Long live the resistance. Long live the Intifada.
Long live October 7th. Long live the resistance. Long live Intifada. I think that was Ottawa. It could have been a Chicago City Council meeting, too. They're difficult to distinguish. For more on this, please be joined by Stephen Bucci. He served America for 3 decades as an Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. Is a visiting fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies as well. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It is always my pleasure to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
Just want to be sensitive. Have any of your family members been eaten by cannibals?
Last time I checked, no. I got a big family, but I think they're all accounted for in more normal circumstances.
Okay. All right.
So bizarre, though.
I want to make sure. Yeah.
Because the plane, Uncle Boozy's plane was shot down. Didn't he die in the water?
He disappeared, yeah.
Disappeared.
In the Pacific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah, he may have been eaten by something, but probably not cannibals.
They're good swimmers, some of them. I don't know. Anyway, so, Stephen, about this foreign aid bill, $95 billion worth. Ukraine gets the bulk of that, with Israel in second place and Taiwan in third. Was this the right move for House Speaker Johnson and congressional Republicans to make?
Remains to be seen whether it'll be the right move for the Speaker. Obviously with the rule we have now where, one person can put you out of the Speaker position, it's a strange set up right now. Clearly support to Israel needed to happen. I frankly could have seen them give more to Israel. But the amount of aid to the Palestinians in Gaza, I'm sorry, some of this stuff is such fiction. There's been so much aid pumped in there, and if you look at some of the math, there's been enough aid that has gotten in that the Palestinian people in Gaza should have been fed for the last year for a year since this thing started with no problem at all. So all this starvation and stuff that's going on is frankly manufactured not by Israel but by Hamas. They're the ones, once the stuff gets in there, that don't distribute it to the actual people. What they're doing with it, I don't know. They're feeding it all to their guys. Their guys would all be pretty fat by now. But so the aid part, okay, fine. So they decided to do that. But the part to Ukraine, again, there's such a split over support, continued support to Ukraine. I hope they're putting in a really robust methodology to track where every dime goes, because they're going to be required to do that in the future when somebody starts asking the questions. Not saying that there's a guarantee that they're wasted or anything else, but there's enough people asking that question, serious people, not just crazies, that there's a responsibility from DOD and Department of State to make sure that that stuff is all used appropriately and they can account for every bit of it in a positive manner, or there's going to be some probably some problems later on.
Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google and Alphabet and all that, he penned this op-ed. Apparently he knows something about Eastern Europe, or at least is pretending to. His op-ed in The Hill, and this was in support of the vote that happened to move the aid out of the House. He writes, the war in Ukraine has entered its third year. This one could prove decisive. Ukraine has a pathway to a military and diplomatic victory, but so does Russia. Putin is amassing a strategic reserve in preparation for spring offensive. He feels emboldened after a sham re-election to take even more territory. Only more artillery cells and air defense missiles will allow Ukraine to halt Russian advances and turn the tide in a war that threatens its very survival. Ukraine wins if it can continue to counter Russia's onslaught with allied support. Russia wins if the West fails to support Ukraine. That's pretty generic, but is it directionally correct?
I think it is directionally correct, but yeah, it's a bit thin gruel as far as specifics that he's talking about. You know, Putin is clearly continuing his effort to not just keep the part of Ukraine here that he has taken, but to get more of it. That's still what he wants. That's still what he's pushing to the Russian people. It's still what their propaganda is pushing around the world. And Ukraine doesn't want to give it to them. They want their terrain back, and they want to continue to be a sovereign nation with freedom to decide who they associate with and who they don't. Not leaving that to Vladimir Putin.
But isn't the argument that's being made by all those flag wavers, I mean Ukrainian flag wavers, not American,
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
The Ukrainian flag wavers in Congress, that if Ukraine falls, don't make this about Ukraine, because if Ukraine falls, then other dominoes start falling. Poland gets the next knock on the door. Do you still believe that? Or, I mean, I'm not saying that you did believe that, but do you really believe that? Does Putin have the... not just the disposition, but the bandwidth to start rolling through former, countries that were formerly behind the curtain and trying to reassemble Mother Russia as it once was? I just don't get the sense that he has that capacity. He may have that dream, but I don't think he has that capacity, does he?
I don't think he has the capacity that if Ukraine fell today, that next week he could start the next offensive into another country. It might not be Poland. It could be more than likely the Baltic countries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're even closer to him and further away from everybody else in NATO and less robust militarily than Poland. But would that be part of the plan? I think you can't dismiss it as, well, he doesn't really have the capability, and that's really just a pipe dream for him. I mean, who thought taking Ukraine back was, on the plate? But it turned out, and all the experts, including myself, said, well, he's just stomping his feet, doing that exercise on the border. He's never going to actually do this full-up invasion of Ukraine. And then, son of a gun, he did. He is very, very determined to reestablish what he considers his due as the head of an imperial Russian entity that is a superpower alongside of everybody else. So I don't think, it's not a sure thing, but I don't think it's one we can completely discount that he would then turn around, maybe not immediately, take a year off as he's done in the past, and then start the next round of nibbling at the neighbors, if you will, and in some cases taking big honking bites like he's done in Ukraine. I don't think we can say that's not a possibility, to be honest with you.
Well, what do the people of Russia think about this? I mean, are they for this, against it?
From what I can ascertain from the things I've read and the people that I trust that have been inside Russia and listened to it, there's a good chunk of the Russian people think this makes perfect sense because they're being fed a line from the Kremlin that Ukraine was tuning up to attack Russia, that, you know, there's Russian people's grave persecution inside of Ukraine. Those folks who believe that propaganda are saying, yeah, go for it, boss. But you got to remember, they don't really have an option to not say that.
Right.
But there is significant pushback still, particularly from, you know, the mothers and wives whose husbands and sons are going off to fight in Ukraine about this war. They don't necessarily think it's a great idea, but, you know, they don't have the same sort of channels of dissent that we have in the West. So it's a little hard to tell that. I don't think the Russian people are behind this, but it's to not be behind is somewhat personally dangerous for Russian citizens.
Right, of course. Right. I mean, this is not something that's done by plebiscite. This is one guy's decision. But I got to tell you, the arguments being made from both sides in defense of this are, you know, really insulting. One, this from Jerry Connolly, who's a Democrat from Virginia on the House floor during debate.
Some say, well, we have to deal with our border first. The Ukrainian-Russian border is our border.
No, it's not.
That's
hard virus first.
Yeah, and then Speaker Johnson saying what we've heard before, including from Democrats, is rather send bullets to Ukraine than our men, than our fighting men and women, as if that's the only choice. If we don't send armaments, then we're ultimately going to be compelled somehow to send American troops. No, we're not. That's not true. Those are both specious arguments, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, they need to do a better job of making the argument that they don't have to use the bumper sticker slogans to do it, and that does cheapen the effort. Jerry Connolly is kind of a demagogue, you know, having
clearly
lived in Virginia. He's out there. Speaker Johnson knows better than that, and probably could do better. I realize he's dealing with a lot of issues at one time, but that argument is kind of weak sauce.
Well, and it's not just insulting intellectually. It's also insulting to Americans who are suffering real loss. There's this piece in the American Conservative by a gentleman named Jameson Carrier, who is actually running for Congress now in Indiana, but that's secondary. He writes, Monday, April 15th was the two-year anniversary of the worst day of our life, the day my wife Kathy and I lost our son Joey to fentanyl poisoning. Our family isn't alone. There's been a 1,000% increase in fentanyl deaths among young people from 2020 to 2023. Over 100,000 American sons and daughters are dying every year due to fentanyl. That's more than 300 Americans dying every day from fentanyl poisonings. If a jetliner was going down every day, we would stop everything and get it fixed. So, of course, in addition to all the crime that's been documented the proximate cause of open borders with just allowing people into this country willy-nilly at their choosing, then you have obviously the drug traffickers and the human traffickers layered on top to the gangbangers and the random criminals. And so, you know, that's the thing that's, I guess, doubly insulting is sort of the moral indignation that comes from the political class about spending money in these foreign theaters when in our backyard we can't seem to muster the political courage to draw a line and say nothing crosses this until this is dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree 100%. The border is a much bigger and much more significant issue to America as a whole. And just, you know, just if you wanted to rack and stack the vital national interest, protecting your border is way up there. I mean, it's like the most significant. The problem you have right now is the administration doesn't see it that way. And even if you pass the law for that, I'm not sure, you know, it would survive the veto because the Democratic Party has such a tight discipline in supporting a Democratic president. It's that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. And frankly, it doesn't mean you can't do both. But to do the exterior ones and not do the border is that's a miss. That they blew it on that one.
One other issue I just wanted to get your take on too, because it's a little bit below the fold but important since we're so focused on Putin and everybody in Congress is such a a Putin bull. Niger in Africa, we've got commandos and drones, ours, being kicked out of Niger, however you want to pronounce it. And Russia filling the void left by America and the French.
That is a significant problem. It is a, it's not the value of Israel and Hamas or Russia and Ukraine or China and Taiwan, but it is significant. The Russians are making inroads into a lot of these places in Africa in the same way the Chinese have done and the Chinese are doing in Latin America. And that's not something, we would have allowed 25 years ago or a little further back than that. But now everybody's like, okay, well, what's the big deal? Well, it is a big deal. That gives them influence. It gives them platforms from which to do other mischief. And it's something we could counter with relatively small footprints and small investments of effort and personnel, and to not do anything about it or to just sort of look the other way like it's not important is somewhat short-sighted in my opinion.
Well, the other issue too is that we lose a strategic location in terms of trying to combat Islamofascism and the terrorist organizations that propagate it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That there's some value in having the connection with those individual nations and their governments, certainly. But in the bigger scheme, you need to be – Africa's a big place. You're not in Africa, you're not going to get much done from the outside, coming in periodically. You have to have some sort of enduring relationship, albeit – probably, minuscule compared to what we do elsewhere. But if you're not there, it's kind of hard to take action when the need arises. And that's the other big reason where we have been in there for the last 20, 25 years trying to rebuild those relationships. And now we're just sort of letting them go again.
Stephen Bucci served America for 3 decades as Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies now. Stephen Bucci, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yep, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Remember that? Remember that? Like one-hit wonder from the 80s? Remember that when they were like glam rockers and they were doing this like robotic dance?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yep.
I was just thinking more because there was a more cannibal talk during Mike Scott's newscast. Tony Gonzalez talking about the cannibals inside the House Republican caucus. I hope they keep Biden's relatives alone.
But did you see when he was making that statement in Scranton, Pennsylvania, there was a dude behind him who was like, what is he talking about? I thought I was here for... touting the economy and inflation numbers. You're talking about your uncle or grandpa who was eaten by cannibals in Papua New Guinea?
Uncle Bozy.
Uncle Bozy, yeah.
Yeah, you would have thought that, over the last 50 years, you would have heard about Biden uncle serving in World War II was eaten by cannibals. That seems like a story that would have gotten out by this point. But,
It's such a bad lie. Oh,
all right,
delusional.
So... a couple things here. First of all, I wanted to update our listeners on the Marlboro Township, New Jersey school situation. Mom addressed the school board last week claiming that a teacher is on video molesting her 13-year-old daughter, and the school board tried to sort of brush it under the rug and allow the teacher in question to quietly retire. Mom was having none of it. This is some of what she said last week.
Failed. my daughter. You failed to establish mechanisms to prevent abuse, to prevent the atrocity that happened down that hallway to my 13-year-old daughter. My daughter was sexually abused in this school, in a hallway, on a camera, by your teacher, Jenna Shabika. You let this predator in our school. No denying.
And since she went public with that, the police had been essentially alerted. They investigated. Now that teacher in question, 38-year-old female, mm-hmm. has been charged with one count of harassment. She denies the allegations, but regardless, she has been charged. So police found enough probable cause to make an arrest in the case. So good thing mom spoke up.
Yep.
Let that be a lesson. And dad, too. Dad was there. Oh, I guess her father and the woman's husband, she said, had going through chemotherapy, so he didn't talk. She talked on his behalf using the 6 minutes for the two of them, and good for her. So, I mean, just, you know, closing the circle here. Yeah, sometimes you're not just spitting into the wind. You may be spitting into the wind in terms of addressing that board, but you pressure politicians into acting, or law enforcement to act where politicians are afraid to, or or they're just complicit with bad behavior that's going on under their watch. I mean, it's just nice to, you know, close the circle on some of these where you do speak up and you do get results.
It's good to get a win sometimes.
Pressure. Pressure, pressure, pressure. The trick of politics, as Milton Friedman famously said, is getting the wrong people to do the right thing. Stop waiting for the right people and pressure them to do the right thing. Right. Although you could, you know, places like Chicagoland, you could make a lot better choices, too, from the available options. But I digress. So that brings us to this rather interesting commentary from Bill Maher. I'm not a huge fan because I think he is generally what he decries. And he doesn't understand that sort of his atheistic, quote-unquote, libertarian philosophy is the source of so many of the societal ills that he then bemoans. And he mainly comments in the interests, even though when he turns his sights on the left, he's mainly saying, be better because I want you in charge. That's what he's mainly doing. He's not, Bill Maher is bolting from, no, he's not. Saying, be better, you're going too far, I want to win elections, I want you in charge. That's different. But nonetheless, I'll give credit where credit's due, and it's due here.
Oh, yeah.
Because he is exposing something that, again, the press corps, the political press corps, the entertainment press corps, you know, averts their eyes from. Although this Quiet on the Set documentary about Nickelodeon is opening some eyes, like the Neverland documentary on Michael Jackson did. And here was Bill Maher over the weekend on his program talking about that documentary and what it says about Hollywood and the hypocrisy of the leftist cultural mavens in this country. The rich honkies in wealthy suburbs and on lakefronts, like in Chicagoland.
Or ocean fronts in California.
Their rank hypocrisy. And, I mean, and could the issue be any more serious when it's the sexual exploitation of children? They're still hypocrites about it.
So I don't know if this documentary is the talk of your town, but it is out here because it didn't just expose a dangerous workplace. It also exposed hypocrisy. Because it must be pointed out that when the evil governor of Florida was saying the exact same thing about kids and creepy stuff at Disney that liberals now find intolerable at Nickelodeon, he was dismissed as a hick and a bigot. But why would a kids' content factory like Disney be all that different than the one at Nickelodeon? A 2014 CNN report discovered that at least 35 Disney employees had been arrested for sex crimes against children. And in 2021, Disney child star Alison Stoner confessed she only narrowly survived the toddler to train wreck pipeline. The next year, child star Cole Sprouse told the New York Times that young actresses at the Disney Channel were heavily sexualized from an early age. You know, Willie Sutton said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. And the reason we find pedophiles in the Boy Scouts and the rectory and kids' TV is that's where the kids are. DeSantis wasn't wrong, but we're so tribal now, the left will overlook child f***ing if the guy from the wrong party calls it out.
Don't say gay.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. And I love what Bill Maher said at the beginning, too. He's like, I don't have kids. I don't even like kids, but why am I always defending them?
He left out something in his list of the Boy Scouts and the rectory and Nickelodeon or Hollywood.
High school?
Government schools.
Government schools, yeah.
Yeah, government schools. We talk about hypocrisy. Anybody want to talk about the Chicago public school system? Talk about government schools writ large? There's been academic studies of it. We've talked about innumerable times. The Shake Shaft report and subsequent studies actually confirming her initial findings and suggesting it's even more prevalent than she estimated. Who's taking up that as a cause celeb? Right. And on the Disney and Nickelodeon comparison, for all the heat that DeSantis took from all of these ignorant, wealthy honkies on the North Shore and in the Western Burbs and in places like Oak Park and River Forest. Don't say gay, bigot. Exactly what Bill Maher said. So, yeah, Nickelodeon and Disney. Remember Brian Peck? Bill Maher does.
And get this. After Brian Peck, who was one of the lead creeps at Nickelodeon, served 16 months in prison for the molesting he did there, Disney hired him.
No.
Naturally, to work on a children's series. Oh, for pedophiles in Hollywood, it's a small world after all.
Sing. The social justice warrior, as Maher calls it, hypocrisy. These cultural Marxists. But of course they're hypocrites. I mean, the idea that I say again, I mean, this is fun and it's a good rant that he goes on. But remember, hypocrisy is part of their privilege. There is no requirement for intellectual or moral consistency because this is the naked advance of political power by any means. And I don't know why we expect them to be consistent or fair-minded. I mean, that those are not traits that get you to the sort of power over other people that they desire. And since they're not getting punished for their barbarism, why would they stop? Why not have rules for me and other rules for thee? We're the vanguard class. You're the unwashed masses.
And people who believe in social justice have agreed this is wrong and this is bad, and exposing kids to an adult world of lurid costumes and garish makeup borders on abuse. Now, hurry up and get in the car. We're late for Drag Queen Story Hour. Not that there's anything wrong with being a drag queen, but maybe it's time to admit that sometimes Drag Queen Story Hour is more for the queen than the kids.
Oh, you think?
Sure, kids love a clown, but does the clown have to have And when I see a five-year-old tipping?
I know.
At a bar under a sign that says it's not going to lick itself,
ew.
Do I have to pretend that's cool in order to keep my liberal ID card? Sorry, I can't do that. If you want kids to be more tolerant, why not have handicapped people read them stories? Kids are more likely to encounter disabled people than drag queens in life. Geez, can't we just go back to the good old days when kids were read simple stories with simple morals like, if you're a lonely single man, just make a boy out of wood.
Yeah. How about that? Right. All this. Oh, by the way, I don't know if she was listening, but did you just catch that? Leslie Sadowski Fugit, Downers Grove Village Board. We spent a lot of time dealing with monster last week. Did you catch that? Did you catch what Bill Maher said? It's not Dan Prof saying it.
It's
Bill
Maher
talking
about
your hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Grooming, sexualizing kids. You know, you keep pressing it, and he talked about all the books and all, and then you're surprised. Oh, and all of a sudden, when they were having that fight in New Trier Township over the banners, where New Trier neighbors wanted religious freedom, but you know, of course, Wilmette is all, you know, all LGBTQIA2S+++, and you know, right? It's so invisible; it has to be everywhere. One woman, you know, got up there during public comment. She talked about having like two trans kids. You know what the odds of that happening?
Slim to none in Slim Left Town.
Yeah, this is this is social contagion. You push, and all of a sudden you get something back. What a surprise! And you don't. If you don't want to call that grooming, then you come up with another term. Of course, the hypocrisy. And then these trained SEALs in the audience just laugh and clap along when they've been party to all this nonsense. That's what's so frustrating. But at least Maher stuck the landing. At least he made the point. And maybe it will have some resonance somewhere. I doubt it. But all you can do is tell the truth, I suppose. Mike in Littleton, Colorado.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Honestly, it doesn't even resonate with him. If that guy was given choice, Bill Maher, between Donald Trump or Mark Robinson and a pedophile, he would either choose not to vote or he'd vote for a pedophile. That's our problem. And so would the SEALs in the audience.
Yeah.
So I don't know what we do about that. I mean, the psychosis of the nation. Woo. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, right. So he defends DeSantis for being unfairly slimed by all of those yapping SEALs in his audience. But at the end of the day, right, if it was DeSantis versus whoever in Florida, you know, pick your off-the-shelf leftist, where's Bill Maher? Where are you going to find Bill Maher? With the off-the-shelf leftist. Right. Even though he's pointing to the same thing that Maher is otherwise, you know, heroically standing up for in his own mind, which is the prevention of the exploitation of kids. But you're not allowed to do that. I mean, so that happened. But then this is the actual culture. You saw the story about this 18-year-old student who penned like a 130-page manifesto about carrying out multiple school shootings in Montgomery County, Maryland. And Montgomery County, Maryland's like Cook County in terms of the demographics, political demographics. It's completely lost its mind. It was like one of the lockdown centrals, enthusiastic lockdowners and everything left and everything cultural Marxist. And it turns out that the student that they arrested is a chick pretending to be a dude.
Mm-hmm. Transgender. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Here we go again. Another example. And so a reporter questioned the Montgomery County executive, this guy named Mark Elrich, like, why are you not saying the characteristics of this person? Why this? You're not disclosing that this person identifies as a woman who identifies as a man, that this girl has. Well, he didn't say it this way, but I'd be basically insinuating that this girl has a mental illness. And that maybe is part of the discussion here.
What is the reluctance of the county to admit that this individual was transgender? This is the fourth time that we've seen this happen very recently. And right here, I hear all of our leadership saying to us today, and what we do in journalism here, what we try not to do, is bury the lead. Why am I hearing about this from the New York Post?
Because it's not a lead. You know, how do you publicize every time somebody gets murdered that it's a white Christian male who's heterosexual? No, well, are these the only crimes that get committed? But, you never publish somebody's sexual orientation when you talk about this. Why do you focus on it?
Let me try that again.
What is the reluctance of the county to admit that this individual was transgender. This is the fourth time that we have seen this happen very recently. And right here, I hear all of our leadership saying to us today, and what we do in journalism here, we try not to do, is bury the lead. Why am I hearing about this from the New York Post?
Because it's not a lead. You know, how do you publicize every time somebody gets murdered that it's a white Christian male who's heterosexual? No. Are these the only crimes that get committed? You never publish somebody's sexual orientation when you talk about this. Why you focus on it being a transgender is beyond me. It is not a news story. It is not a crime to be transgender. And I'm sorry you feel that way.
That's not what I said.
Yeah. Yeah, right. He didn't say it's a crime to be transgender, but that's the straw man argument you erect to not even hide your hypocrisy, to come over the top of your hypocrisy with moral indignation, which is a good example of what happens routinely. Yeah, and Bill Maher's little commentary is not going to change that.
If they're a white male Christian, they tell people, and then like white Christianity is not affected with or related to white supremacy.
Of course,
it's a whole rigmarole every
right,
single time.
Identity matters when it's convenient for us, and it doesn't matter when it's inconvenient for us, of course. Chris Northbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, just what happened to Men Raising Men and following along with what got us all to this point. Lucky enough to be from an affluent area, but I've gone through the same problems inside my family as well. And there's nothing wrong with standing up for the values that got us where we're at and believing in and what's right and wrong. And if we don't stand up for it, we're going to lose it all.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, we have some sad news to report.
No.
Because he was such a friend of the show. He'd appeared on our show many times, and I just did a podcast with him for American Greatness, 4 or 5 weeks ago. Really good. He was a smart guy. Kevin Brock, former assistant director for counterintel for the FBI. You've heard on this show, maybe you read some of the op-eds he wrote for The Hill and other outlets. He passed away last week, 69 years old, and I was reading, I guess he had been battling cancer for a while, but I had no idea. At legacy.com, there are a lot of great testimonials from obviously former colleagues and people that knew him. I'm going to post one myself after the show. But yeah, Kevin Brock, he was great because one of the things that he was able to do is talk substantively about the agency he worked at for almost three decades. To talk honestly about it, like he loved the agency, he loved the work, he loved a lot of the people that he worked with. He would be very frank about all that, but he also recognized where the agency had lost its way and the individuals who were responsible, and he was willing to name names and he was willing to talk publicly in a way that a lot of people won't do, you know, because they don't want to, I'm besmirching my agency and I don't want to cast a negative light on people whose work I do respect there by criticizing the leadership whose work I respect less and so forth.
He just wanted to hold them accountable.
Well, right. And if you don't have an agency that's accountable to, you know, to us, to the American people, then, and it has that much power, then you got a real problem. And he recognized that America is more important than the FBI. And the FBI is supposed to understand that rank order of importance. Anyway. So, yeah, very sad news just to hear of Kevin's passing. All right. Bill Barr was on with Neil Cavuto the other day. Of course, Cavuto asking about Trump and who he's going to support. See if we can get a story out of this. Bill Barr is, you know, mum on Trump and so on and so forth. It's sort of idiotic stories the D.C. press corps loves. Anyway, but Barr went through his usual cost benefit on Trump. But the bottom line is that he sussed this out correctly.
At the end of the day, you have to remember, serving in his administration, I was fine with his policies.
Right.
I think his policies were good policies. My problems came with his behavior, which I found very troubling after the election. And I think, you know, I think the idea that he's going to be an autocrat and take over power like some right-wing dictator is not the threat facing our country. The threat facing our country is from the far left and the drift that's been occurring toward really a socialistic system, and one that brooks no opposition, that cancels people, that has only one viewpoint taught in colleges, that you know, tries to push parents out of the picture when it comes to the education of their children. It's a heavy-handed bunch of thugs, in my opinion, and that's where the threat is.
He's right about that, but some of Bill Barr's behavior, too, in retrospect, was a bit troubling, not in the sense that there was any, I don't think there's anything unethical, but I think that upon further reflection with what we know over the last couple of years, he was a little bit slow on the uptake, and maybe that's because he was an institutional man for so long. He let things go on that shouldn't have gone on, in my view, which is why I'm pleased to have our next guest to talk a little bit more about that. James Burnham, Senior Associate Counsel to the President, Deputy Assistant Attorney General at DOJ, and Counselor to the Attorney General under the aforesaid AG Barr. He's now the Principal at King Street Legal, PLLC. James Burnham, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Barr's, since you wrote this piece over at City Journal opposing any future special counsel, so maybe we'll start there and then fold in Barr, because, of course, he appointed one. I think my sense of the summation, I guess, of your piece is the special counsel. I mean, you know, the independent special counsel, like a Jack Smith, is indistinguishable from the regular prosecutor, like Fani Willis, or like an Alvin Bragg. And I know that's federal and state, but I mean, the comparison holds up. The point is, there's no such thing as an independent special counsel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there should be. And I think when you have someone like that, things sort of inevitably get out of control, because the attorney general doesn't feel like he has an obligation to supervise the prosecution. It's a quote-unquote independent prosecution. And then inevitably, when you have a special counsel where the target is known in advance, as there always is, and as there was with Smith, the people who join the team are, you know, tend to be people who really want to go after that target. That was certainly the case with the Mueller investigation, which I, you know, played a small part in as a witness. You know, the team was very Democrat based on their past political giving. Elizabeth Blogger. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew Weissman. I mean, yeah, they're all on MSNBC right now.
Right, right. Exactly. You got it.
Yeah. And so, right. So, I mean, but so on the special counsel, though, piece too. So he saw the whole thing happen with Mueller, and he's a sophisticated guy. I'm talking about Barr. And he's been around DC for a long time. He knows how this works or doesn't. And then that Durham investigation just labored on and on and on. And there was no appointment of a special counsel. I know you're arguing against them categorically, but I mean, we're either going to do this one way or we're going to do it another way when it came to Biden Incorporated. And then now we get, you know, then you get Garland that appoints Weiss, who tries to cut an unholy deal, and her, who pulls the punch on Biden because he's congenial and old and forgetful or some such thing when it comes to classified documents. I mean, it's just a mess. And doesn't Bill Barr, I mean, is it fair to say that Bill Barr had a blind spot there?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, the Durham, you know, I was not involved in the Durham investigation in any meaningful way, but my sense was, and I think the AG Barr said this publicly, part of the problem was COVID really slowed things down. I mean, you couldn't get a grand jury. So in order to file subpoenas and things like that, you need to get the grand jury together in person. And many of the courts shut that down for over a year. And so it was a really, I mean, it was unfortunate. I don't know that there was an obvious way around it. In terms of appointing more special counsels, I don't think that would be, you know, that was would have been a good idea then or was necessary. I think the accountability for the Biden, the things of Biden and David Weiss fall squarely on Merrick Garland's head. And the Senate has an obligation to hold him accountable for that when he comes for hearings, as does the House. It's an outrage.
Well, but okay, so then if no special counsel, then how about Barr's Department of Justice? Where were they? The FBI had Hunter's computer, we know, the laptop, we know now for a year while Barr was attorney general. So, I mean, the whole Biden Inc. operation, it seems like Barr completely missed or was uninterested in.
Yeah, I really couldn't say because I was not. I left the department in May of 20, and I was not privy to any of the inside knowledge about Hunter and the current president or any of that. So I really just don't know. But I do think that the current Justice Department has an obligation to investigate everything that is happening and can do so without special counsels. I don't think they need to appoint Robert Hur. I certainly don't think they need to appoint Jack Smith. And they have an obligation to run this stuff down and prosecute it if it's appropriate. Yeah. Rather than have the two-tiered system we have now, where you've got Jack Smith, the war crime prosecutor, running full speed, and everything that's happening involving the current president going at, like, you know, one-quarter speed.
Do you really see a world where we wouldn't have special counsels anymore? I mean, do you think that that is actually feasible?
Absolutely. I think the Justice Department is fully capable of investigating the current president, the former president, as needed. I mean, Mueller is a great example. I mean, the deputy attorney general at the time, Rod Rosenstein, could have easily convened some sort of prosecutorial task force to investigate whatever he felt needed to be investigated about Russia collusion. He could have supervised it. And if he had found, as he did find, and as Mueller found, that there was no there, he could shut it down and say, look, there's nothing here. We're moving on. And that would have been much better than letting Mueller spin out of control for 2 years.
Right. And I mean, so just going back, I mean, just in terms of like doing a case study for lessons learned, thinking about how to do this prospectively, was Sessions got a lot of criticism for recusing himself. Was he wrong to recuse himself, delegate that to Rosenstein, and watch that play out as it did over the course of the better part of 2 years?
Yeah, so I wasn't, you know, I don't know what advice he got from the career ethics people, but my view is you're the Attorney General of the United States, appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. And boy, the standard is awfully high for you to recuse, particularly on something that is going to the heart of the new administration like this, where it seems pretty clear in retrospect that a lot of people in the Obama administration had been setting this up for a while as sort of a spring trap to catch us as soon as we came into office. So I don't know if he would call a mulligan now if you ask General Sessions, but you know, I was not a fan of that decision at the time, and I think it looks, you know, it looks like it may not have been the right call in retrospect.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Jack Smith classified documents case and the Hur report and the, you know, the recommendation there and ultimately how that plays out in court? Because the judge in that case seems to be pretty skeptical of this seemingly different standard of prosecutorial discretion when it comes to classified documents.
Well, look, so I think in some ways this highlights the problem, or one of the problems, with special counsels. It makes no sense to have two different independent decision makers applying different standards on their own when both are nominally part of the Justice Department. And so I do agree that the same standard should obviously be applied to President Trump and President Biden. And when you have two separate independent people, you run the risk of applying different prosecutorial standards, and it just looks ridiculous, like a two-tiered standard of justice. And that's obviously bad. As far as Judge Cannon, the judge who has the classified document case involving President Trump, you know, she's gotten a lot of heat in the press for, I think, being appropriately skeptical about Jack Smith's extraordinarily aggressive attempts to make this case happen and make it happen on a political timetable. You know, to me, I do a lot of defense work, you know, that doesn't involve people like President Trump. And criminal defendants in high-profile cases get railroaded all the time. And I guess I'm kind of glad to see that, you know, at least here it's getting some attention and that Judge Cannon has the fortitude to stand up to these guys.
Well, yeah, and they also, you know, all of, you know, how incestuous the world in D.C. is, and so, sort of these worlds, generally speaking, when you get to the upper echelons. But we find out, like, you know, like we, like Merchan, the judge in the case in Manhattan, you know, his daughter does work for Schiff and all these antagonists with political antagonists, Trump and so on and so forth. But that doesn't even raise the appearance of a conflict of interest. So he says he's the arbiter of what's a conflict of interest, of course, not going to recuse himself. Jack Smith's wife made documentaries for the Obamas. Worked with Hillary Clinton. I mean, so, and not to mention what his sort of profile is as well, that's well known. It's going back to, we were talking about it with Andrew Weissman and FBI, McCabe and Comey, and everybody ends up with a book deal from the same place and sitting on a contributor gig at MSNBC or some other outlet that's antagonist to Trump. I mean, but none of this is a conflict of interest. All of those people are able to separate their political dispositions from their professional responsibilities, we're told. And if mistakes are ever made, they always just seem to be made in the direction of negatively impacting their political opponents. It's very curious how that works. So I just, you know, that the whole thing, it seems to me, just needs, you need Republicans to lead on this, to say there is no such thing as this. These are, this is like unicorn stuff when you're talking about these independent prosecutors who are just there to look at the facts for, you know, objectively and apply the same standard regardless of the political affiliation of any particular target of an investigation. That's just complete fiction. And now, over the last 8 years, very few people believe it, no matter how many times you say it anyway. So you might as well just acknowledge the truth. At least that would be my advice and counsel to a President Trump if he were reelected.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, there will be people around, if the president is reelected, or President Trump is reelected, he will have people telling him that he should appoint a bunch of special counsels to investigate Biden and, you know, his various antagonists. And I would just say that's a bad idea. It's not going to work. You know, he will get no benefit of the doubt in the way that Jack Smith and these guys get the benefit of the doubt. The courts will not, it'll get portrayed as being a total political witch hunt, you know, led right. by him.
Right.
And it won't work. And so if he wants to investigate things that should be investigated, he should appoint a smart, competent attorney general. And that attorney general should do it inside the Justice Department with, you know, prosecutors. The attorney general can select the prosecutors, but then needs to supervise and be able to defend what the investigations are doing. I think that's the only way it would work.
Yeah, right. I mean, they're going to be, you know, Trump's handpicked lawyers one way or the other. So, right. I mean, so you might
exactly.
as well do it in the cleanest way possible. What do you have any perspective on the FBI and working with the FBI under Comey or Wray, particularly against the backdrop of FISA being re-upped last week or moving towards re-upping?
I think the FBI is a difficult institution to deal with when you're in the government. And I don't think there's much question that the next administration needs to think hard about how to kind of get the FBI more in line with the Justice Department. I mean, one of the things that somebody told me once that I thought was a good point is, so the FBI director is supposed to report to the deputy attorney general. I mean, not supposed to, they do. They're below the deputy attorney general on the org chart. But the FBI director has an airplane and the deputy attorney general has no airplane. So what does that tell you? Comey is an example. He had been the deputy AG before he was the FBI director. People shouldn't see it as a promotion to go down the org chart, but you get the plane, you get the building. So I think if President Trump does come back, I don't think there's much question that Chris Wray would probably leave of his own accord. That's what everybody seems to think, and that checks out to me. He should appoint a director who's willing to sort of put the FBI back where it's supposed to be, which is a subordinate sub-agency of the Justice Department, not some, you know, Praetorian Guard independent agency that nobody can control.
Anybody you recommend?
That is beyond my competence.
Okay.
I don't know. Not me.
I like that. That's okay. That's a really good point about the who's got the plane, just to give you a sense of the FBI's sort of mission creep, or more than creep, actually. James Burnham, Senior Associate Counsel to the President, Deputy Assistant Attorney General at DOJ, and Counselor to the Attorney General under Trump and Barr. He is now the Principal at King Street Legal, PLLC. James Burnham, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Simon Steele? He's the executive secretary of the UN Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's a mouthful. The next 2 years, it's make or break it for the planet. Where have we heard this before? Essential to in saving our planet. We still have a chance to make greenhouse gas emissions tumble with a new generation of national climate plans, but we need these stronger plans now. That's what he said. The main task for the UN's climate negotiations in Azerbaijan is for countries to agree to a new target for climate finance to support developing nations struggling to invest in shifting away from fossil fuels and fighting climate change. Oh, you mean developing nations like China and India? We're going to need to come together with a plan to finance China and India so they could reduce their carbon emissions by shifting away from fossil fuels as they're building coal-fired plants? Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good plan.
Yeah. That's plausible. We need to help figure out a way to finance Bill Gates wanting to cut down millions of acres of forests in the Pacific Northwest to bury the trees to reduce climate emissions. Needed to finance the removal of cows, the replacement of them with camels or some such animal that has less methane emissions and so forth. 2 years and lots of cash. Same old playbook. They're just updating it, would seem to me, but let's ask our next guest. He is Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, the author of Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. Patrick Moore, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Nice to be back with you, Dan and Amy.
So 2 years and we got to come up with some cash. The backdoor Green New Deal in America is nice, but that's just the beginning.
CO2 emissions have increased again this year to a record level. This is a good thing because that's what plants want, to grow our food, and all our forests and all our wild land are benefiting from the emissions of CO2. CO2 is invisible. That is why they get away with claiming that it's harming the world, because no one can see it. And if you can't see it, you don't know it. It's a simple fact in science that observation is the most important part of discovery. You have to see it, and you can't see carbon dioxide. The fact is, every commercial greenhouse grower in the world pumps extra CO2 into their greenhouse to get 30 to 50 to even 70% increase in growth of the crops that they are growing for us to put on the table. And this whole thing about invisible is the real problem. You know what else is invisible? Radiation. And they're saying that nuclear power is a problem because of radiation. Well, you can't see it, so they can make up any story they want, and it's all a big lie.
But
for
they
some
are
reason.
Well, they argue, you know, you can't see it, but you can measure it. And so here are the measurements. And here are the projections, and we took these measurements and we put them in a model, and here's the projection. And if this projection is accurate, you know how it goes. The global temperature increases by X percent or by X degrees over the next 20, 50, 100 years. Then here's what we know would be the implications per the output of our models. And this is what drives all of the apocalyptic talk.
Yes, but the fact is, it is impossible to predict the future of things like CO2 and the effect it would have on the climate. We do know, theoretically, that even if it had some effect, it would be extremely small compared to water vapor, for example, which is also invisible, but which is one of the main drivers of the temperature of the Earth. Then there's clouds. Clouds are far more important in terms of warming and cooling. But the really actually hilarious thing about all this, Antarctica, for example, is 5 million square miles of ice, bigger than the United States, even including Alaska and Hawaii. 5 million square miles of ice. That's because we're in an ice age. And the North Pole doesn't have quite that much because it's a bit warmer in the Northern Hemisphere than it is in the Southern Hemisphere. But we are in an ice age. This is one of the coldest periods in Earth's history. Life did just fine when there was no ice on the Earth for 150 million years before this ice age set in. And it took 50 million years from the peak of the temperature, the Eocene thermal maximum, look it up, it's a real thing. It happened 15 million years after the dinosaurs went extinct from an asteroid that hit the Earth, which was a lot more exciting than what's going on now. Right now, we are in a cold period. And actually, I'm in Baja, and I've been here, coming here for 25 years, and it's colder this spring than it has been since I started coming here. The ocean is still too cold to swim in. And so, but everybody's talking about how this is the worst heat that anybody has ever seen in the history of the planet. Well, since 1850, apparently.
So, but
there were quite a few years before 1850, like 50 million, 100 million, 200 million, 300 million. And people should wake up and do some study. Just, it doesn't take much. Look up the Eocene thermal maximum, and you will find out that the Earth was much warmer and life was flourishing in Antarctica. There were forests there at one time. That was a nice period of time. The Sahara was green at one time, mm-hmm. but when it gets cold, there isn't as much moisture in the air, there isn't as much rainfall in these areas, and the people who lived on the Sahara 8,000 years ago had to go into the Nile Valley, and that's where Egypt started. So, I mean, there's so many actual easy truths to convince you that this is not a hot period in the Earth's history. We know this for a fact. And computer models cannot predict the future.
You've got your 50 million years, but Greta Thunberg, her climate strike is in week 296. And just last week, Stockholm took a part in it, and they're demanding climate justice now, whatever that is. When you watch these movements and you see the protestations and the lists of demands and the pronouncements from lofty perches like the World Economic Forum, what do you think is going on?
What is going on is the use of fear of the future to control the population. It's as simple as that. You know, it wasn't that long ago they were burning witches. It wasn't that long ago that they were throwing virgins into volcanoes as a way to appease the gods or whatever you want to say. And we still are a very primitive psychology and hierarchy of the people who, like Bill Gates, I mean, for goodness sakes, he wants to cut down forests and bury the wood.
Right.
The wood is what is absorbing the CO2, and let them grow. Don't cut them down and bury them. That's about the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And Bill Gates is one of the stupidest people that exists on this planet for having he surely has had an opportunity to get a decent education with all his wealth.
But so the bottom line is, you think they're all doing this, and like Bill Gates, just to maintain the population of the planet?
I have no idea what possible rationale there is for saying that we should make the Earth cooler than it is now, when you have 5 million square miles of ice on the southern pole, where there were forests not that long ago, geographically or whatever you want to call it. In terms of the time of the Earth, It's 4.6 billion years old, this Earth. And life began almost 4 billion years ago, maybe 3.75 or something like that. We don't know. There's two things we'll maybe never know. How did life begin, and is there any other life in this universe besides this planet? And most people think, well, of course there must be. Yeah, no, you can't say that if you don't know it, if you haven't seen it. You know, this is, people project the future when they have absolutely no clue what is going to actually happen. I mean, look at what's going on in the United States and Europe, Canada, a few other countries are trying to stop the increase of carbon dioxide emissions. Meanwhile, China is tripling their practically. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't sad.
And people are
falling in with this.
What should we make of, you know, all this anecdotal reporting is, you know, this much of the polar ice cap has melted, but then there's other reporting about, well, this shoreline that was supposed to have disappeared by now has actually grown. You know, all of this sort of one-off about either some animals' numbers or some iceberg or some island's shorelines or, you know, amount of ice in the case of glaciers. We're supposed to divine real importance from these developments. How do we process that?
You process it by knowing that the warmest oceans in the world are in Indonesia, and there you have the highest number of corals and reef fish on the planet. Mm-hmm. So if the Earth warms, the reefs will expand, because the thing that is controlling their growth is cold water, not warm water. The Earth was much warmer 50 million years ago, and the coral reefs expanded over a much larger area. We know that for a fact, and yet they go on about how if the Earth warms, the coral reefs will die. No, if the Earth warms, the coral reefs will expand into the warm oceans that would be happening. But we have absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the Earth will continue to warm. We're in what is now a 300-400 year slight warming period called the modern warm period. The Roman warm period was warmer than it is now, and that was only 2,000 years ago. We are in now a 6,000-year slight decline in temperature. And if it matches up with the previous 2.5 million years of interglacial periods and then glacial maximum periods, we are headed now into the 80,000 year or so descent into the next glacial maximum. So you don't have to worry about your kids. It's not going to happen that fast. But in terms of the patterns that have been occurring during this Pleistocene ice age, you have this pattern of interglacial periods and then glacial maximums. There's been about 40 of them, and it appears very clearly in the record that we are headed into a downward trend for the next 80,000 years if it follows the same pattern it did for the last 2.5 million, where it's very clear. We know that from Antarctic ice cores, from all kinds of proxies, that is the pattern that has been occurring on this planet since it went down into the Pleistocene Ice Age, which we arbitrarily call 2.6 million years ago. That's
right.
Where we say, okay, now we're in an ice age, and we've been in it ever since.
All right, well, we'll keep updating this every couple thousand years with you to see how this is tracking along. Patrick Moore.
That's a fine riposte you have.
Patrick Moore, co-founder of Greenpeace, his book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. Patrick Moore, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank.
Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.